Well, welcome back to the podcast, everyone. You're here with Lutfi, Joanna, and myself, Nathan, of the PRT Weekly team. Lutfi's new to the discussion, so why don't you say hi, Lutfi, to all the people out there?
Hey, everyone.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name is Lutfi, and I'm a first-year student at the UBC MPPGA program. And I'm excited to be part of the podcast group.
Yay!
Right. And everybody should know that Lutfi is the new director of communication, so he's big boss now. So everyone defer to Lutfi on all things. And also, if you are an MPPGA student listening to this, send the man some blog posts. We'd love to get some more content up on the website for all our listeners and readers to enjoy. This week we got a great episode for you, but before I get to that, make sure you subscribe on iTunes if you haven't already. We are now on iTunes, which is very exciting for us. So head over to Apple Podcasts, search for PRT Weekly, and give us a subscribe. Maybe some feedback would be good too, only if you give us 5 stars though. That's all I want. So this week we've been talking about Xi Jinping consolidating power at the 19th National Congress, which is the huge congress that happens in China every year. Every
5 years.
Yeah. So this week we'll be talking about Xi Jinping consolidating his power at the 19th National Congress. After that, we'll be moving over to a bombing that happened in Somalia and Mogadishu and how it went severely undercovered by the media and some other angles. Following that, we'll look into Spain and the bold move by the government to look to dissolve the Catalan government and what that means for democracy in that country. And then, as per usual, at the behest of Joanna, we have a quirky story at the end to leave things on a quirky, if not happy, note, depending on how much you like croissants. if you like croissants, this might not be a happy story. So, jumping right into it, I'm going to throw it over to Lutfi, our guest of honor and big boss man, to talk about Xi Jinping consolidating his power. Tell us a little bit about that.
All right. China. Yesterday, the Chinese Communist Party handed Xi Jinping, the current president of China, his second term. And the Chinese Communist Party basically gave him a power at the level of the old chairman Mao Zedong. Now, Xi Jinping, over the years, he has given himself so many titles, right? Not only he's the president of People's Republic of China, but he's also the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, and he's also the commander-in-chief of People's Liberation Army. He also gave himself the title party's core leader. So he's basically the chairman of everything.
Right.
So this Congress is different from the previous Congress China had because Xi Jinping was given a special treatment whereby his name was written in the Chinese constitution.
Ooh.
So he basically the only third person that was written in the constitution. The first would be Mao Zedong, and the second one would be Deng Xiaoping. But keep in mind that Mao Zedong was basically the father of People's Republic of China, right? And Deng Xiaoping was obviously the person or the guy who opened China's economy. He basically created the Chinese capitalist system, or they call it socialism with Chinese characteristics.
Right. And so tell me a little bit more. From what I understand, some of the things coming out of the 19th Congress is this question surrounding China's new mantle of global leadership, with the U.S. sort of retreating a little bit, right, and what it means for China's international policy, seeing as now Xi Jinping's sort of philosophy has been put into the constitution, making his stance on China's place in the world difficult to retreat from, right? So what is that new stance in the world?
Well, that's a great question, because unlike his predecessors, Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin, Xi Jinping actually, he's really interested in making China the new leader of the world. We saw this in the recent Davos meeting when he mentioned that China is ready to take the global leadership, whether it's from international trade standpoint or managing the global climate change threat. Unlike Donald Trump, just like you said, he's retreating back or stepping back from global leadership. Now, there are implications when it comes to China's pursuit of global leadership. We see this in South China Sea. We also see China's increasing foreign aid initiatives. Some of those moves are soft powers, but we also have to pay attention to the more aggressive, assertive China again, South China Sea is a really great example.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah, just a final note on that. I would say I would personally be more worried about Chinese soft power as opposed to hard power, because if you look at the sort of the three dimensions of power, militarily, China is still very much outmatched by the U.S. and its allied system, as much as the U.S. is straining those relationships. Yeah. But in terms of developing countries looking towards China to create stronger economic ties and create all these different things, their soft power and their influence on the direction for leading countries into different types of frameworks than from American leadership would be, it's not so much dangerous in that I don't think Chinese philosophy in the development is dangerous so much as a declining superpower and an increasing superpower might be a dangerous sort of mix in the world. But Joanna, you had a thought.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, as much as in terms of soft power, this is really interesting in the way that Xi Jinping's kind of presenting China's image in the world is really important to notice. But I think looking at the soft power, it's important to also, like you said, look at the kind of more hard power that's beneath it. And so, you know, looking at, you know, what is the goal behind this move, and what is the goal behind increasing development assistance, and what is the goal? I think the Chinese leadership is always really strategic in the way they plan things, and so it's just going to be an interesting, I guess, something to watch and to watch what China's doing in the future.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's definitely something to watch, and we'll keep an eye on it as we talk about the podcast. So moving on, we're going to talk now about a bombing that happened in Mogadishu a couple weeks ago now.
Yeah.
But we wanted to talk about it at the next chance we got. So I'll let Joanna sort of take it away.
Yeah. So this bombing, it happened on October 14th in Mogadishu, which is the capital of Somalia. And so it did happen quite a while ago, I guess 2 weeks in the news cycles, a long time. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to talk about this because I think that it was a devastating attack. So it was a suicide mission, essentially, allegedly from Al-Shabaab, which is the Al-Qaeda affiliated group in Somalia. But I don't think they've claimed it. But it killed, the estimates go from 350 to over 400 people died in this. And beyond that, it's just caused absolute devastation in Mogadishu. I think what's important to notice here is both, you know, it's important to notice the ongoing threats and the ongoing instability in Somalia and the struggles they're having with terrorism. But it's also very important to notice, in my opinion, how little coverage this attack got, given its scale and given the amount of coverage that attacks such as the shooting in Las Vegas or attacks in Paris or London garner. I think we need to analyze this discrepancy in attention that was given to this absolutely enormous, devastating attack in Mogadishu, and look at why certain areas of the world are covered more than others.
Yeah, those are all really great points. And from a standpoint of conversations and security in the world, some of this, you know, goes into the discourse that we have, where a lot of the threat is framed in the media in terms of, you know, ideologies against the Western ideology, right? But you can see that when Somalia doesn't really fall into that framework of being an attack on a Western ideology, it could be one of the reasons it sort of floats underneath that sort of discourse, because it doesn't fit into that framework, right? And it doesn't seem to fit into the way that we understand terrorism through a Western lens and through Western media, which is part of the issue as well. But this is part of a conflict that's been going on for 10 years. It's absolutely devastated the country, and this is the largest attack since the conflict started. So you would think it would be something that was worth mentioning.
There's also an aspect of, you know, our interest or the United States interest in the region, right? There's not much interest in Somalia's economy. Mm. Therefore, there's lack of coverage of what is happening there. Although, you know, the amount or the numbers of people who were killed by the ongoing violence in that particular country is really enormous. And if anything, the only thing I can remember or I can come up with in terms of the United States or the Western interest in Somalia is with regards to Somali pirates, because a lot of, you know, commercial ships are being hijacked by these pirates. But in terms of internal issues, it's been getting really a lack of coverage.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that serves that speaks to the point that our image of Somalia has become a bit of a caricature of you know, this failed state, of this, you know, frontier of ingovernability and chaos. And I think that, you know, that is one image, but we also need to analyze why it's unstable and why it continues to be unstable despite the attention that has been being put on its instability. So,
I mean, first of all, I think we should note that the African Union forces that have been in the country have largely stabilized the city centers. It's more the rural areas in the country that are seeing a lot of instability. So that fits into that character. I think there are areas of the country that are fairly stable, which made this bombing as devastating as it was, because it did happen in quite a stable area. So, Joanna, final point?
Yeah, my final point would just be that this bombing also kind of brought to the fore kind of some, in a potentially positive light, it helped illuminate some problems and some spaces where improvements could be made, such as in the local capacity to deal with such events like this, as well as, there's been a big movement to encourage people to donate blood, and it's been difficult in terms of social stigma, perceptions of it being against their religion, or perceptions of needles being dangerous. And so there's been a big push to change the attitude in Somalia around the donating culture. And I think the story in general brings attention to the fine details of what development is and how you can actually make it make sense
and
work.
Absolutely. So we'll move on from there to Spain and the conflict happening right now between the Catalan government and the Spanish government as a whole. And as we talked about on the last episode, Catalan held a referendum to secede from Spain, which brought about a lot of conflict in the voting polls, and largely because the Spanish government had deemed the referendum to be illegal, but the Catalan government went ahead with it anyway. So there's clashes between Spanish police and Catalonian citizens, for lack of a better word, I suppose. And now Spain, in response to this, in response to Catalonian demands, Spain has moved to try and dissolve the Catalan government, saying that holding a referendum that was illegal is an affront to democracy. And this is a very, it can't be overstated how bold a move this is on part of the Spanish government. The response to an area of your country looking to secede and to sort of really batten down the hatches and say, okay, you lose all your representation within our system and your special status, because Catalan had garnered quite significant special status in the country. They had a lot of independence. They had a lot of ways of governing themselves and economic windfalls, but they wanted more. And so now there's going to be very, very protracted legal battles between the Catalan government and the Spanish government, and the Spanish court system's going to have to, this is a constitutional issue, and they're going to really have to try and figure this out.
It's been really interesting to watch the dynamics between the central Spanish government and the Catalan government. It just has been filled with animosity from the very get-go, and I don't know. I wonder why there couldn't be more discussion.
Part of the reason is there is sort of a dislocation between on three levels, between the Spanish government and the Catalan government, between the Spanish government and the Catalan people, and also between the Catalan government and the Catalan people. So the Catalonians went to the vote and overwhelmingly voted to secede from the country in this illegal referendum, according to the Spanish government. But the Catalan government didn't necessarily want that either, because at the negotiating table, there's very little room to maneuver now, because there's, aside from seceding, there's very little between what special status they have now and just outright seceding.
Right.
And so the negotiation is very tight, which is sort of why you're seeing these extremes put out, because there is no space between what there is now and seceding. So the options for the governments are to retreat to their extremes.
Right. And it's probably also important to kind of give some historical context and kind of bring to light that this, until the 80s, I believe, it was a fascist country under Franco. And so there's a fear of this kind of pushback from the central government and the oppression. And so that's part of the reaction story, I think, and part of why it has been produced in such a way.
Yeah, and the one thing that I think a lot of people overlook is that people are pretty much focusing mostly on the cultural and the political aspect of Catalonia's relationship with the Spanish central government. But there is also economic issue whereby there is a $10 billion annual gap between the amount of money that citizens of Catalonia pay to the central government and the amount of service that they get, they receive from the central government. And, you know, and the central government has not been able to even acknowledge that.
Yeah.
Right? And that's a really serious issue that they need to look at.
Yeah, and maybe if they acknowledged this economic dynamic, then it would make the negotiation easier or at least more, friendly.
Right. And then their last gasp effort in sort of dealing with this is if this all fails at the national level, the Catalan government is looking to deal with this in international courts. So like I said, this is going to be a very protracted legal battle, and I don't think we should see anything happening overnight here unless the risk for violence would be too great if something happened very rapidly.
And again, it'll be interesting to watch and important to watch because, you know, this we're in an age when there's a lot of separatist movements, a lot of people who aren't feeling part of the national whole that they're apparently members to. So this will be an important example to watch to see what happens.
Absolutely. So finally, we're going to move on to our quirky story of the day, because as usual, Joanna insists here at PRT Weekly that we end on somewhat of a lighthearted note.
Yeah.
But I have to say, as somebody who really, like, croissants of life for me, they're my absolute favorite. So this story brought a little bit of a pang to my heart and is a little bit heavy for me. But why don't you explain?
All right. So I am sorry that this is such a hard story.
It's hard for
you.
Me. Yeah.
So the story is that basically in France, some store shelves are empty because there's no croissants. They're having a butter shortage. There's a shortage of milk products in France and in Europe in general. And this is a very important ingredient in croissants, which are pretty much, I read an article that said a fourth of croissants is butter. And so, without the butter, they can't make the croissants. And so there's a bit of a struggle coming on. And, you know, this butter shortage is a big problem too in the Thanksgiving and Christmas season. So, I mean, it is quite a sad story.
Why is there a butter shortage, though? I mean, why did this just happen? They've had abundance of butter for decades. What happened?
So it essentially comes down to supply and demand. So last year, the apparently demand for butter was very low, so supply went down. And now demand has risen significantly, and supply just isn't able to catch up to it yet. So, it just can't catch up.
So what you're saying is that the benefits to producers was too low because
the price was low.
Weren't getting the price, so suppliers left the market. So, I mean, if anything, the good news here is this is a great news story for CETA, the Canadian-European Trade Agreement, because now Canadian milk and dairy products can just go ahead and flood the European markets and save the French croissant.
Save the French croissant!
Yeah.
As quirky as it sounds, this is actually serious. Imagine if there's lack of kimchi in Korea, or in my home country, there's lack of soybean cake in Indonesia.
Tempeh,
exactly. People would go in the streets and protesting and start a riot, probably.
It is true. The French do have a very, very interesting relationship with especially breaded goods. Let's not forget, the French Revolution started around a bread shortage.
That is true.
Oh, dear.
God save Macron if he comes out and says, let them eat cake.
You guys are twisting my happy story.
It's not a happy story.
I know it's not a happy story.
It is a quirky story. I'm sure economic forces, I'm sure all our economics professors are sitting listening to this going, you know that the market will fix itself. Eventually, because now demand is high, the price will go up, more suppliers will jump into the market, hopefully Canadian suppliers to keep those Ontario and Quebec dairy farmers happy.
Just don't start hoarding your croissants, everyone. That won't help.
I'm going to personally start hoarding croissants, or what I might do is start making croissants and shipping them to French people in need. That'll be my charity for the month.
Wow, that's excellent. Yeah. Can I take this opportunity, since this was our sad attempt at a happy story, to request anybody who sees a happy story, send it our way.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Just send it to PRT Weekly, to the pub, please. We need happy news stories. They're incredibly hard to find, but they exist. I'm certain.
To that end, that brings us to the end of the episode this week. So thank you for listening in. As per usual, I'm going to remind everyone to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter as well. If you do want to get in touch with us for any reason, if you want to submit ideas or give us feedback, you can contact us at mppga.coms@gmail.com. So you can reach out to us there. And again, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and leave a review. It helps us out a great deal. And make sure you check out all the great content at pubpoly.com. And we'll see you again soon.
See you. See ya.